This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In late April 1970, Marshal Eddie Conway was arrested in Baltimore, Maryland, for murder he maintains he did not commit. Shortly before his arrest, two Baltimore police officers were shot while sitting in their patrol car. Officer Donald Sager was killed, while Officer Stanley Sierakowski was critically wounded. Two suspects were arrested at the scene. A responding officer reported seeing a third man who got away. That officer identified Conway as a third man through a set of photos. Additionally, a police informant testified that Conway made a jailhouse confession. At the time, 24-year-old Conway, a U.S. Postal Service employee, belonged to the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party. As with Panther chapters around the country, the FBI was conducting undercover surveillance of the Baltimore members' activities as part of the controversial COINTELPRO operation. Due to his political activities, Eddie Conway and his supporters believed that he was either framed or that as a target of the FBI, he was unable to receive a fair trial. No physical evidence linking Conway to the scene of the shooting was ever presented, and he denies ever confessing to the killings. In the 40 years since his incarceration, in addition to fighting for his freedom, Eddie Conway has become an activist within prison walls. He formed the Maryland chapter of the United Prisoners Labor Union and works with the ACLU to improve prison conditions. Marshal Eddie Conway also co-authored his just-released memoir, Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. His co-author is Dominique Stevenson, and she joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Dominique.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the origins of the case itself, what happened in 1970. I gave a few details about it while introducing you, but what are the pieces of evidence that point to the fact that Eddie Conway was potentially framed?
Well, because, one, the evidence was, like, scant at best. The police officer who identified him actually from a photo lineup. Eddie's picture was the only picture, and there were two photo lineups that he was shown. Eddie's picture was in both of those lineups. The issue of the jailhouse informant is bogus. He did not make a confession to this man. This man was offered a deal. He was moved from Maryland to Michigan to serve out the balance of his time. So he was offered a deal in return for going into court and saying that Eddie confessed to him in the cell. Eddie protested this man being placed in his cell because he had gotten word that they were going to try to do something of that nature.
So he's been in prison since 1970?
Yes.
And has he received a new trial? I mean, and what were the original problems? I mean, did he, like so many other people at that time and even till today, did he have, you know, adequate defense that he was, you know, that he had confidence in? Or was it a court-appointed lawyer who botched things?
Yes, it was a court-appointed lawyer whom he protested this man being on his case. The judge forced him to go forward with this lawyer on the case. If you look at the trial transcripts, it's clear that he objected to having this person represent him, particularly on a homicide charge. William Kunstler, at the time, you have to understand what was happening. One, the Black Panther Party all over the country, the tactic that the government was using was to lock people up. It was depleting their resources. It was tying up their lawyers. And so Eddie was attempting to get a political lawyer because he saw it as a political case. William Kunstler came to Baltimore, went before the judge, and asked for 30 days in which to send someone to represent Eddie. The way it turned out, the judge, I think, initially agreed to that, later on reneged. The case went forward. And so Eddie was saddled with a local lawyer who, some years later, I was told by another attorney in Baltimore that this man had like a shred of credibility because at one point he'd been a really good lawyer, but by this time he was an alcoholic and it was very clear. And this person also suggested that he was drunk during the course of the trial. He didn't raise many objections. And like I said, the evidence against Eddie was scant. There was never any physical evidence. He felt pretty much that he was targeted because he was in leadership.
I mean, it's like a cookie cutter story these days when you hear about cases like this. Of course, this one being one of, you know, perhaps the oldest ones of its kind, an African-American man, politically active, accused of some kind of a crime. He maintains his innocence, gets a terrible lawyer, and ends up in jail for decades, fighting for a fair trial, and eventually, you know, to get some traction and some support. But it's just it's so sad to hear about cases like this. Let's go back to Baltimore in the 1970s. Tell us about the activities of the Black Panther Party. Listeners may not realize that Baltimore was a city where Black Panthers were quite active.
Yes, and it's interesting too, because the history of that particular chapter and other chapters is they from the very inception, they were under attack. What we found out later is that one of the key people who started that chapter, a man named Warren Hart, was actually working in some capacity on behalf of the National Security Agency. So many people like Eddie, who got involved in that chapter, who were young, very idealistic, wanting to have impact in their community, were not aware that they were being set up from the very beginning. Eddie questioned some of the things that this man was doing, and he reported those things to New York, the New York chapter, which sort of had charge of the Mid-Atlantic region. And Donald Cox, who recently passed, Black Panther Party member, came down. There was an investigation, and Warren Hart was removed from leadership. And Eddie feels that as a result of that, as things escalated, he was targeted, because he probably also would have been in a prime leadership role as things played out. So at best, you know, there was probably a good 6-month run for the chapter in Baltimore. It went, the chapter continued, but by the point of, I believe, his trial or shortly afterward, chapters were being recalled to Oakland, because at that point the Black Panther Party had decided that they were going to really focus locally on Oakland.
And what sort of level of FBI surveillance did the Black Panther Party in Baltimore, did the chapter in Baltimore suffer? Because as we, you know, many of our listeners know, the history of COINTELPRO is a very sordid one, and it was designed to undermine to really tear apart the fabric of so many of these political organizations. The Black Panther Party was among the lead organizations targeted by the FBI's COINTELPRO program.
Yes. Well, it wasn't even just the FBI with Baltimore. What they found out is that they were infiltrated by a number of law enforcement organizations.
So like, just local police?
Yes. If they had food police, they probably would have been in there. You know, it was that extensive. Like I said, Warren Hart was in somehow involved with the National Security Agency. There were people representing the local police. There was just deep infiltration. And ultimately, what Eddie said he believed is that they felt that with Warren Hart, they would be able to infiltrate the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party.
So Eddie Conway is 65 years old now?
Yes.
And tell us about his life and times in prison. For the past several decades, he's been imprisoned, and he has not been quiet. He has not remained silent. What has he been doing there?
From the very beginning, he's been working, he's been organizing and doing the same things that he was doing as a member of the Black Panther Party. He spent the first 6 or 7 years pretty much in isolation, on lockdown. But even there, folks were working together. He was working with other men. They were studying the Little Red Book. They formed what would become a group that really held true to the tenets of the Black Panther Party. It was called the Maryland Intercommunal Collective in the prison. So they were providing education. They had implemented survival programs. He went from that to being released finally into the population to working constantly with the men, or attempting to organize a union, which was put down by the prison administration in a particularly violent way. In some instances, cases, he faced attack from prison guards. He now is working, has a mentoring program that has actually expanded into other prisons in Maryland. We've been able to take that to several prisons as men are moved through the system. And they focus a lot on really working with the young men, negotiating between the street organizations, or what some folks would call gangs, negotiating between those groups, really working with young men so that they come back into the community in a more whole way, trying to have some impact beyond the prison. They're really, most of the men that Eddie works with and that I've had the opportunity to work with in the prisons are very concerned about what's happening in the community beyond the walls.
My guest is Dominique Stevenson. She's the co-author with Marshall Eddie Conway of the book Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. And now, what's amazing about this this book that you've co-written with Eddie Conway is that it brings to light the fact that even before the very well-known case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose commentaries we air pretty regularly here on Uprising, was the story of Eddie Conway. Why did the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal get so much attention? And this similar situations, both accused of killing a police officer, both active in the Black Panther Party, both very politically active young men at the time of their incarceration. Why the difference in attention between the one and the other?
I think, one, because Mumia's case was critical in that it's a death penalty. You know, it was a death penalty case. I think also because Mumia has always been a writer. He's always been someone who has had the ability to communicate with folks.
And he wrote the introduction to this book?
He agreed to write the introduction. It's not in there. Okay. Because of the difficulty in really being able to reach Mumia, we weren't able to secure it. So we're hoping that when there is a reprint, we'll be able to put it in there.
And so he supports the case of Eddie Conway, too?
Yes. The interesting thing is they were born, obviously, in different years, but a day apart. So I think Mumia's birthday is April 24th, Eddie Conway's is April 23rd. But there are a lot of similarities between their cases and other political prisoners, you know. But I think that Mumia has... his case was critical, and people looked at the fact that his life is on the line.
So what is the status of Eddie Conway's case? Is it pretty much a done deal? Are there appeals in the works? Was he ever able to get a new trial?
He is actually looking forward to going into court this year. There have been appeals over the years, but at this point, we hope to see the case in court either in the fall or the winter. Coming up, there were two co-defendants on this case. One of them died in prison. The other one, Jack Johnson, was released last year. When he went into court, the judge said that at that time in 1970, life did not mean life. So I think that provides some legal grounds also for Eddie, because it's the very same charge.
And what are some efforts around the country and even in Baltimore and Maryland itself around supporting Eddie Conway? Has his cause been taken up by activists in a big way?
I think it has, but I think that Eddie, as well as other political prisoners, Russell Maroon Schultz, I think, is a case of someone who people don't know much about. I think that to some degree, people have forgotten about these folks. And while there is a core group in Baltimore, and there are people in Oakland, there are people around the country who support him, as well as outside of this country, I think that more effort really needs to be made on behalf of these folks. Leonard Peltier, there's so many people. They're growing older. They put their lives on the line, you know, for what they believed. And in many cases, so that we could benefit from the things that they were willing to challenge about this system.
And in many ways, I mean, these are the casualties of the 60s, of the people who fought in the 60s, very ferociously for people's right to dissent on a variety of issues, racial justice, against the war, etc. I want to ask you, Dominique, how you came to be involved with Marshall Eddie Conway, and, is he able to communicate with the outside world with ease?
He is at this point able to call outside, and we've, in the past have been able to set up radio interviews with him. Eddie also engages classrooms. He's worked with Dylan Rodriguez down at UC Riverside, speaking to his students. So he's been fairly accessible and willing to really reach out beyond the prison. I initially was just, interested in the case. and actually outraged by the fact that he is incarcerated. I do believe that he's innocent. And so I got in touch looking to do whatever I could do to support him. And through that, he encouraged me to come in and work with a broader population, you know, within the prison. And that's Eddie. It's like, you know, he felt that people inside would benefit from the contact with folks outside. And so we began doing programming in the prison. And it's been nearly a decade of doing that work inside with him. It's been really great. But this man needs to be outside in the community so that folks can benefit from that knowledge and experience that he has.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit more about his work inside a prison. I had mentioned a couple of things that he was involved in inside a prison, the United Prisoners Labor Union. He's also worked with the ACLU. What sorts of rights has he won for prisoners inside prison?
With the ACLU, there was a case, I think this was back in the 90s. The Maryland House of Corrections was overcrowded, and they simply sued to reduce the size of people within the prison. And it actually did change the environment in that prison a lot. And you know, so that was his main work with the ACLU. A lot of his other work has simply been starting programming inside, looking at needs, you know, whether it's literacy issues, whether it is, like I said, mentoring, you know, working with young men who have shorter time who are going to come back into the community. It's been, a lot of it has really been that kind of hands-on work with youth.
And has he become a sort of mentor to younger men inside prison?
Oh, definitely. Inside and outside in Baltimore, he has had that kind of impact. Mm-hmm. But yes, you know, I go inside, I see the love that these young guys have for him. I also see when they come out how they try to maintain that transformation that's taken place for them politically, you know, and personally through the work that they've done with Eddie.
Finally, how can listeners get involved with this case? If he is looking to appear in court this year, is there a campaign to bring up public pressure and public support for his case?
There actually is. There's a move at this point in Baltimore to push for clemency. This has happened previously. So there is going to be a movement requesting clemency. In the works right now is a city council resolution that will ask the governor for clemency in this case. There has been one previously in I think 2001. So there are a group of people working on that as well.
Is there a website that listeners can find?
Yes, he has a website, www.freeeddieconway.org.
I've been speaking with Dominique Stevenson, the co-author of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. You can find out more online at freeeddieconway.org. You can also search on facebook.com for more information. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I want to quote Nelson Mandela, who once said, "For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." That's Nelson Mandela. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Our assistant producer is Martina Steiner. We had